Welcome to the Civitas Podcast. I'm Peter Leithart, and I'm here today, as usual, with my co-host, James Wood. The Civitas Podcast is an outlet of the Civitas Group, and the Civitas Group is, in turn, a project of the Theopolis Institute. The Civitas Group was formed in order to be a colloquium, a discussion group that covered questions of political theology and particularly focused on current debates concerning liberalism and post-liberalism. And our group and this podcast is devoted to exploring those issues and also to articulating our distinctive ecclesiocentric post-liberal vision for modern societies. Today, we are very privileged to have a special guest, Dr. Nancy Piercy. Dr. Piercy's latest book, which we'll be talking about, is The Toxic War on Masculinity. Her earlier books include Love Thy Body, The Soul of Science, Saving Leonardo, Finding Truth, and she wrote two ECPA Gold Medallion Award winners, How Now Shall We Live, which she co-authored with Harold Fickett and Chuck Colson, and Total Truth. Dr. Piercy's books have been translated into 19 languages. She is professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. A former agnostic, she has spoken at universities such as Princeton, Stanford, USC, and Dartmouth. She's been quoted and cited in The New Yorker and Newsweek magazine, highlighted as one of the top five women apologists by Christianity Today, and hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. We're very delighted to have Dr. Nancy Piercy with us today. Welcome.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here as well.
As I said in the intro, we're going to be talking about your book, Toxic War Against Masculinity, and I want to start with a couple questions about the origins of the book. How do you see this book fitting in with other books that you've written? That's question 1A. 1B would be, what is it that you're responding to? Was there a particular logic in the way that in what you were doing with your other books that led to this, or were there things going on in the culture that you wanted to address in the book? What was the source and inspiration?
The way it fits in with the earlier books, especially Total Truth, is I have an entire chapter there on the Industrial Revolution and how it affected the family. And in part, that was what I wanted to do with this book, is go further, go deeper, because that was just one chapter. And I thought this warrants a whole book, because the Industrial Revolution had such a huge impact, not just on the relationship between men and women, but also the whole public-private divide, which in itself reflects the fact value split, the split in the concept of truth. And so it was all interconnected. But I didn't want to write about women. In Total Truth, I spoke about the Industrial Revolution primarily in its impact on women. And I thought, I'm bored with women. I don't want to do this again. There are whole libraries of books on women's history because of the feminist movement. When I turned to men's history, I found almost none. Really, two good books on the history of masculinity in America, and then some smaller ones on the history of fatherhood and so on. And I thought, well, see, this is really fresh and new and different. And by the way, that is probably why some people have found the book different from what they have heard before, because I was speaking more from a male perspective, you know, these male historians who were writing on the history of masculinity. That's part of it. I had done a little bit on that work before, and I knew that it warranted even more. And then the second thing, you 1B. There were really two things. One is, I was very surprised at the level of hostility that it's become socially acceptable to express against men. One of the first articles that caught my eye was the Washington Post, that had an article titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" I thought, really? In a respected mainstream publication, a Huffington Post editor wrote, hashtag kill all men. You can buy t-shirts that say, so many men, so little ammunition. And you can buy books that say things like, the titles are literally, I hate men, or no good men, or are men necessary? And then sadly, even some men are jumping on that bandwagon. A fairly well-known male author wrote a book in which he said, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. And then you probably saw this because it was in the news. It's not in the book because it was more recent, but the director of the movie Avatar, James Cameron, was in the news saying testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system. So partly the book was inspired by trying to understand, where is this coming from? You know, can we get to the bottom of this? Why is it that the secular world gets masculinity so wrong? You know, I am an apologist at heart. And so I wanted to critique the secular view of masculinity.
I was going to ask you about that, about one of the points you just made, that so few people talk about this issue and so few people talk about it well. And that's why you think many people are maybe even surprised to see you addressing it. One of the things I was going to say is probably why it's garnered some attention as well. It's got a great title, you know, so if you came up with that or your publisher, it's very catchy.
I did.
Yes. So, but how have you, in response to the publication, I follow you closely online and we've interacted there and I've seen you handle yourself very well in response to your critics, but you have been criticized from both sides of the kind of political aisle, the ideological spectrum. How have you seen people misread what you're intending to do in the book before we get to your big arguments?
Well, they mostly misread it because I haven't read it, right? Like the Twitter debate that you saw, most of them had not read it yet. And I'll back up and tell you that even in the manuscript process, this was the most controversial book I've ever written. And that took me by surprise, because Love Thy Body, my earlier book, is about abortion, homosexuality, transgenderism, which is really exploding now. But I did a lot of classes on the manuscript. I did a lot of reading groups. I like to get a lot of feedback to sort of rub off the rough edges. And they would tell their family and friends, and invariably the first question would be, whose side is she on? You know, with that tone, whose side is she on? And by the way, the second question was always, and why is a woman writing a book on masculinity anyway? So even before the book was published, men tended to assume that I was going to be a male-bashing feminist. Mm-hmm. More progressive people tended to assume I was an angry, defensive reactionary. Mm-hmm. And so, and then when the book was published, as you know, because you've been watching the Twitter storm, it was jumped on first by Christian egalitarians, who, again, had not read the book, but who argued that I was giving ammunition, their word, I was giving ammunition to complementarians, and that was evil and dangerous and wicked and bad. And they took over my Twitter feed, as you probably noticed, for three or four weeks.
And one thing I'll highlight there is they also really, I felt like they really misunderstood your engagement on the women's suffrage movement. It felt like they really picked up on that, and really it didn't seem like they understood the role that that part of the argument was playing in the book. But
you guys would like this because nobody else really caught the big picture. You know that eventually, you know, after 3 or 4 weeks of being attacked, Jake Medder came to my defense, the editor of Mere Orthodoxy. And that was very helpful because he focused on that question of women's suffrage and he quoted extensively so people could get the context. And he said, she's just being an empathetic, you know, historian. She's trying to understand what this meant to people at the time. And then he said, she's being a responsible historian. Those were his two ways of sort of saying, look, she's just telling you what the what the debate meant at the time. And even he missed the larger debate because what he caught was the debate over women's suffrage had to do with, does a vote mean household vote or individual vote? That it was not framed as men's vote versus women's vote in the 19th century. It was framed as household vote versus individual vote. And of course, most women wanted household vote because that held the man responsible for the common good of the entire household. And by the way, so many people were skeptical of this that I had to put quotes in the book. So I quoted leading suffragists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Ira Harper, Susan B. Anthony, saying, hey, this is weird because most of the people opposing us are women. You know, they themselves acknowledged that most of their opposition was coming from women. And then I had to quote the anti-suffragists so people could get that in their own words. And they also were saying, we want household vote, not individual vote. And the reason they wanted household vote is because they were afraid that if if we went to individual vote, then men would no longer feel responsible for the household. So that would be a reduction in male sense of responsibility. In other words, it was letting men off the hook. Mm-hmm. It was saying men could just go ahead and vote, you know, whatever they felt like without considering the needs and interests of their wife and children. And so you can see why women at the time thought that might not be a good thing. But the larger issue that even Jake Madar missed was it represented, I was using it as an illustration of a change in political philosophy.
Yep.
From an organic view of society where social institutions like the family had a common good. You know, they weren't just collections or aggregates of individuals that the, you know, I look out for what's good for me, you look out for what's good for you, but who looks out for the common good? Whether it's the marriage, the family, the church, civil society, whatever. And that's what authority was for. The person in authority was expected to be disinterested, the favorite word of the day. Back then, disinterested, meaning he was not supposed to look out for his own interest. He was supposed to look out for the interest of the whole. And that shifted roughly the time of the American Revolution to social contract theory, which did say, you know, society consists, a social institution is just an aggregate of individuals who come together out of self-interest. There is no common good. And that means men can no longer be held responsible for the common good. If there is no such thing. So that was huge. It was a huge part of the secularization of the script for masculinity, reducing men's responsibility. That was the goal. That was my theme, is I'm trying to show that the secular script actually has reduced its expectations on men over time. And that's why, of course, people are concerned about it, because men no longer seem to have a sense of responsibility for anything outside their own interests.
Well, I thought that, and that's a very post-liberal argument that those figures were making, even, and so we're very happy about that here at our podcast. But before we move on to other questions, I just wanted to make sure if you could wrap up also how did you see people on the other side misinterpreting the argument you were making? there has been, because it kind of got caught up in the George Gilder drama, and so I just wondered if you could respond to that.
By the way, before I finish, so the Christian egalitarians, by the way, I need to explain, I did not even enter into the discussion of egalitarianism versus complementarianism. And I explained why. I explained why, because two of my main experts said it didn't really make much difference. So the first one was Brad Wilcox, who's at UVA, University of Virginia. He's considered one of the top marriage sociologists in the country. And he says, out of his studies, he did not find that a husband's gender theory made very much difference in whether he had a happy marriage, whether his wife was happy. In fact, Brad Wilcox and one of his colleagues did a study on egalitarian marriages. And he said, we didn't find that they were any happier. They did not test out any happier. And then my second expert was John Gottman. Brad Wilcox is Catholic. John Gottman is sort of Jewish background. And he's best known as perhaps the nation's top marriage researcher, marriage psychologist. And he was a mathematician before he became a psychologist. And so he does very quantifiable measures. And he brings couples in and he wires them up and tests their blood, their heart rate and their breathing rate and their how much they sweat and their stress hormones, and feeds it all into a computer, and has become famous because he can predict with 93.6 accuracy which couples will divorce with only a very short observation period. So he's very famous for that. But he also said he did not see a difference. He said, the couples coming into my practice, some of them believe the husband should be in charge of the marriage, and some of them are more egalitarian. And he said, we're just not seeing a difference. And here's how he puts it. Emotionally intelligent husbands, that's his phrase. Emotionally intelligent husbands have figured out the most important thing, which is how to convey honor and respect to their wives. And so I put that in the book. I said, I'm not dealing with this issue. And here's why. But then, of course, that's what I got jumped on for. You know, people saying, oh, but, you're still giving ammunition to the complementarians, even if you claim you're not dealing with it. So that was kind of ironic. And then the other side, you asked about the other side. Well, Peter, you actually kicked off the other side whether you intended to or not. Because
I'm a bumbling idiot on Twitter. I just put out things and I never see what happens after I put things out.
But I don't remember if it was your excerpt or whether somebody else posted an excerpt from your review, but somebody posted an excerpt on the definition of Azer, E-Z-E-R, yeah, which is the Hebrew word for help in Genesis. You know, the woman was created as a help. And you said, you know, Nancy Piercy rightly notes that it does not mean domestic helper, which is what it means to us today, right? The little assistant, the inferior, the subordinate. But it in scripture, it's used most often of God. So it can't mean inferior or subordinate. Well, it was amazing how many people on the other side, on the conservative side, took offense at that and said, for example, I mean, and I don't mean just ordinary lay people. New Testament professor from Phoenix Seminary was one of the first to jump on that and to say, you're denigrating women's domestic role. Mm. And I said, no, I'm giving you the accurate translation of a Hebrew word. And then thinking I would help, I did a screenshot of the context where I said, you know, it doesn't mean helpmeet, because helpmeet is a misunderstanding of the King James Version, right? Because it was a help, which is a noun, who is meet, which is an adjective, meaning suitable, appropriate, fitting. And it's not a single verb, a single noun, mean helpmeet, which is, since people didn't know what helpmeet meant, they kind of changed it to helpmate. But either way, it's not a real word. I was astonished at how many people are committed to that word. My goodness, they just jumped on me for critiquing helpmeet.
Like, I'm very familiar with people freaking out about critiquing a word.
I've been doing some work on the latter part of Genesis 2 and the creation of Eve. I had studied out Ezra, and I posted some things, I don't know, 6 months ago, and had a little Twitter discussion about it. And somebody on Twitter came up with the phrase battle mate as a good translation. So I've been using that as my translation. I mean, as you point out, every other time the word is used in the Hebrew Bible, it refers to a political or military ally. It's never in a domestic setting.
Yes. And so many people argued with that too, by the way, because in your review, you did use the word battle mate. And finally, I said, look, guys, there's not a contradiction here. Where do you think the greatest, most intense spiritual battles happen? In the home, in the hearts and minds of our children. So of course the woman has to be a battle mate. But, you know, spiritually, of course we should. So that finally calmed him down when I said, you know, I mean, really, we're talking about spiritual battles. They happen in the home. And by the way, I'm really big on hospitality, too. So spiritual battles happen if you bring people into your home and fight the spiritual battles for their souls.
That's a great point. I mean, the direction I was thinking was the first time we have a reference to maternity in the Bible, it's the seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head. Mm. So she's participating in the battle, even in her domesticity, by giving birth to and raising the seed. I want to go back to the suffrage question, not so much on the suffrage question, but the other issues that you raised there. I thought one of the most effective parts of the book was the section where you're tracing out the way that the industrialization splits home and work and creates this kind of morally dualistic social order. And you touched on this when you were responding to James's question about suffrage. How do you see that interacting with the philosophical movements, the fact value question, the development of social contract theory, which you mentioned, which is partly intended to create this kind of this religiously and morally neutral public space so that we don't kill each other over theological differences. So all those movements taking place at different times, but they're reinforcing the same kind of dichotomy. Is that the way that you see them working together?
Yeah, definitely. When you asked that question in your email, I thought back to my book, Total Truth. I have a whole appendix on how the word secular was developed as a way of saying, how do we overcome all these religious warfare? I mean, the 17th century, after the Reformation, there was a century of religious warfare, and people began to say, well, clearly we can't build a public square on religion because religions are fighting each other. And secular became the word that meant a neutral area. Of course, mm-hmm. today we know it's not neutral. Secular means isms like materialism and naturalism, empiricism. It means secular isms. But here in America, where it plays a role in this book is, so prior to the Industrial Revolution, men worked with their wives and children all day on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so the cultural expectation on men was very much a caretaking ethos. As I said before, responsibility for the common good of the family. This is an interesting fact. Most of the books on child rearing at the time, sermons, advice manuals, were addressed to fathers. I mean, if you go to a bookstore today, they're all addressed to mothers. But fathers were seen as the primary parent. And fathers did, in fact, spend as much time with their children as mothers did. So where did all this change? Well, the Industrial Revolution took work out of the home. Men had to follow their work out of the home into offices and factories. And so for the first time, they were not working with people they loved and had a moral bond with. They were working as individuals in competition with other men. And this is where you see the language start to change. You know, in the literature of the day, people started to complain, to protest that men were losing that caretaking ethos of the colonial era, that they were becoming egocentric, self-interested, greedy, acquisitive, look out for number one, make it at all costs, making an idol out of their career. You see a lot of this language already in the 19th century. And at the same time, of course, America was secularizing because people began to say that after the Industrial Revolution, a very large public sphere began to develop with business, industry, financial institutions, universities, and of course the state. And people began to argue that these large institutions should be operating by scientific principles, by which mm-hmm. they meant value-free. Mm-hmm. Just like we hear today, right? Don't bring your private values into the public realm.
Right.
And because men were the ones getting that secularized education and working in that secularized sphere, they were becoming secular earlier than women were. In fact, you see this in the language of the day as well. They were complaining that men were not attending churches often. They were not governing their behavior by a Christian ethic. They were trying to straddle the two worlds. That's where the sacred secular split comes in. And, you know, they were trying to operate by secular principles in the workplace and come home and operate by Christian principles. In fact, one article of the time said, our men are beginning to practice a fatal dualism. That was the phrase, fatal dualism, as they try to straddle these. And of course, that doesn't work. But if values are kicked out of the public realm, where will they be cultivated? In the private realm. And who will cultivate them? Well, women, because they were still in the private realm. And so this is when, for the first time in human history, women were said to be morally and spiritually superior to men. And I like to pause for a minute and let that sink in, because all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, it had been thought that men were morally superior. That the idea was that the insight into right and wrong was a rational insight, and men were thought to be more rational, and therefore men were thought to be more virtuous. In fact, the word virtue comes from the Latin word for man. V-I-R means man, as in the word virile. So the word virtue had overtones of masculine strength and honor. So this was totally new in the 19th century when women were thought to be, you know, were put on the Victorian pedestal and were said to be morally superior. And so, that public-private split does also sort of reflect the, in Christian words, the sacred-secular split, but also the fact-value split. You know, in the public arena, we operate by scientific facts, and then in the private arena, we operate by, you know, personal values. So the
I think what's interesting there is you've got all these couplets, right, and how they correspond to one another. You've got the fact-value couplet, then that corresponds to the public-private, and that corresponds to secular, sacred, and then that corresponds to male, female. Right. And then how that creates all these new tensions, right? Because you said it lifts up women in a certain, it splits men and women in a new way. It lifts up women in a strange new way. And then therefore starts to set the trajectory to denigrating what it means to be a man and creating all these conflicts between men and women. But it's not what I love about your book, and it's building on your previous research on the Industrial Revolution, is it's not just purely in the realm of ideas, but it's also a reflection of the shifts in material realities, right? And so if that's the case, and Peter kind of gestured to this in one of the questions we sent, is what do you suggest? How do we address that then? What are some of the answers, right, of getting men more connected to their homes, more connected to their families? And then ultimately, I think one of the questions we want to ask maybe down the road is getting them more and more connected to the church. But just starting there, like, how do we connect? Maybe it's not public policy, maybe that's too big. But what are some of the lower level steps of how do we reconnect those realities?
Well, you can't write a book like this without having some solutions. So I do have a whole chapter on ways that we can maybe tweak the industrial workplace. And really, the pandemic was a game changer. There were a lot of people who said, hey, we like working from home. I quote one statistic that said, fathers are leading the way. 65% of fathers said they don't want to go back to the workplace full time. They want some kind of hybrid arrangement. And then the New York Times, this was more recent, so it's not in the book, but the New York Times recently had a wonderful article. And it was titled something like, during the pandemic, fathers just got closer to their children, and they don't want to lose that. Mm-hmm. And so the pandemic did show that there's a lot of work that can be done from home. Not every job can be done, but aspects of almost every job could be done at least part-time at home. And at this point, it's more anecdotal, right? So I have lots of anecdotes in the book of people who found ways to work from home part-time. I'll give you just one because sometimes a story can bring it to life. So one of my graduate students, her husband was an IT worker who came home during the pandemic. And because he was home more, he was able to be more involved with the homeschooling. He decided he would be the one to make lunch for the family every day. He was able to take his kids to soccer practice and choir practice. He picked up so many of the family responsibilities that his wife was able to start a part-time job. She's an opera singer, by the way. That was kind of cool to have an opera singer in my class. And she started a voice studio. And the whole family benefited from the added income. And so I interviewed her husband, and he said, our family is so much more balanced now. I am never going back to 40 hours in a cubicle. And then the final kicker was, he said, the time that I used to spend commuting to work, I now spend praying with my wife every morning. So I think that the pandemic can at least help open our eyes to possibilities. And by the way, you have to also talk to the business, the corporations, and help them see that this does work. So I included several quotes from CEOs saying things like, we were hesitant to allow for remote work because we thought people would slack off. And then this CEO said, the pandemic completely exploded that fear. We did not see any drop in productivity. And I quote another CEO saying, people who are parents, if you give fathers the time to be good fathers, they do end up being better workers. So we need to persuade the business world, the corporate world, that this is good for them too. And I think the pandemic did help just open people's eyes to those possibilities.
Couple of responses to that. One is, it's certainly true for a lot of people that they can move home, they can spend a considerable time at home. There are other people that can't do that, as you mentioned. So it seems like some of that setup, that solution or that adjustment, ends up kind of being a class divide where people who are capable of working, symbolic workers, the laptop class, as they came to be called during the pandemic, they can move home. Work at home all the time. I'm blessed to be able to do that myself. I don't have an office other than home, but not everybody can do that. What I liked about your suggestions is that many of them didn't depend on that, having that kind of job or having that level of economic security. You were making realistic suggestions about people in all kinds of different, just the fact that people can give up a promotion that would require them to be at the office another 20 hours a week. It means a somewhat more modest lifestyle, but it's healing that breach between work and home. It's a sacrifice, but it's a sacrifice that's helping to reintegrate those things.
Yeah, so many fathers who were interviewed, you know, the studies that I cited, fathers who were interviewed had to acknowledge that they paid the daddy penalty. They paid the daddy penalty. They didn't come in weekends. They didn't work overtime. In fact, some of them left early. One guy I interviewed said, I just left early 2 days a week so I could coach my son's soccer and basketball teams. Mm-hmm. And he said, my boss got on me and told me I was coasting. He said, but you know what? It did not ultimately harm my career. And when my sons grew up, they said, we want to be a dad like you, which is a lot better than any workplace accolades. There was one example that I didn't put in the book, and which in hindsight, I wish I had, because it was really, you know, very much of a blue collar worker. A friend of ours owns an auto body shop. I mean, he auto repair shop. Well, of course, he can't bring that home. You can't bring a car home, but he can bring his paperwork home. So he brings his paperwork home and he sits at the kitchen table while his kids are doing their homework, you know, and he can discuss their homework. They can ask him questions, you know, so that's why I say not every job can be brought home, but maybe aspects of most jobs can be brought home if we think creatively.
Yeah. And my other thought is that those suggestions, which I think are very good suggestions, are suggestions that are adjustments within this set of dualities that we've been talking about. Those pairs that James enumerated are still there. It's just that we're making individual or family decisions to try to, within our own lives, to try to repair those. Do you have thoughts about what it would take to have a world where those dichotomies are just not structuring the way our lives are put together? One of the things I had in the questions I asked Eric Gregory, we interviewed a couple of months ago, and part of his book on Augustine and the Politics of Love, he talks about feminist theorists who critique liberalism because liberalism affirms a fact-based rationality model of a public life and political rule. And what they want to see is what they think of as more feminine features, feminine human traits, relationality rather than individualism, emotion rather than rationality. Would you affirm that kind of, I'm not asking you whether you're a feminist, but do you see value in that kind of modification of a public ethos? And I guess more generally, do you think that there are structural adjustments that can be made that would not just leave us making the best of a bad situation, but actually kind of redeem the situation, redeem those dualisms?
Well, first of all, I really like those same feminists, you know, Mary Harrington.
Yeah. Yeah.
Louise Perry. By the way, I was on a live podcast some weeks ago, and in the comments section, somebody said, she sounds like Mary Harrington. So I took that as a compliment.
Yes, yes.
because she too, you know, goes back to the Industrial Revolution. And actually, a lot of feminists do. Mm-hmm. It was feminists who wrote on the Industrial Revolution, you know, before men did, before the male historians did. So yes, in one sense, I'm very glad that there are feminists who are beginning to see through, you know, the classic liberalism, the individualism, autonomy rights. And by the way, this is a footnote to what you were asking about the suffrage issue. You know, eventually, of course, women did begin to support suffrage, but why did they do it? It's because the rhetoric changed. They were against the suffrage movement when it was framed in terms of autonomy and individual rights. In other words, liberalism. Mm-hmm. You know, the early feminists were arguing for suffrage in terms of autonomy and individual rights, and the majority of women disagreed. When it changed is when they began to redefine it as a way to protect the household. The key person here was Frances Willard. So she was the president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was the largest. Do you realize it was the largest ever women's organization in American history? It was huge. And she was the most influential figure in the 19th century. You never hear about her in feminist accounts. She's never mentioned in the histories written by feminists. But the histories written by men acknowledge that she actually was the most influential woman in the 19th century. And she finally started to rephrase the issue of suffrage as a way of protecting women from their drunken husbands who would come home and beat them at night. Mm-hmm. And so she rephrased it as the home protection ballot. That's what she called it. And that's when women got behind suffrage, when it was rephrased as a way to protect the home. So isn't that fascinating? Well, and so even there, they were doing what some of these modern feminists are doing. They're saying, no, we want to get away from that liberal language and get back to how do we protect the home as an organic structure. If you ask me for my ideal, so I don't know if this ideal is going to work, but my ideal is the homestead, right? Is to, you know, the Industrial Revolution, after it took work out of the home, eventually took all the other traditional male, traditional family functions, right? Education being one of the major ones, care of young people, care of older and the sick, virtually everything, even hospitality. You know, we don't entertain ourselves in our home anymore with reading books together. We go out to a movie. So many of the functions that had been done in the home and that gave the home a very strong economic and social bonds were taken out of the home. But by the 1950s, there were sociologists saying, oh, but this is good. They were trying to redeem it, right? Oh, this is good. You know, all of these functions have been taken out of the home. So all that's left is emotional connection and relationship. To which I say, well, no, the relationships became much weaker because you can't sit around and relate about nothing at all. You know, you have to have some common activities that you're relating about.
There you do a great job in the book. Now coming even back specifically a little bit to men's issues as well, is you do a great job of like men in this new environment, they are not resourced well to be able to connect. And I think you draw attention, I mean, especially in the fatherlessness issues that and that men, young men are not around their own fathers, and they don't see their fathers interacting with their mothers. They don't even learn how to relationally connect. And so then we start to send, then we try to microwave these emotional demands that you're mentioning there of like, well, but you also say that, you know, men, you know, are not developed, that we're putting too much pressure on the marriage too, where there's not other networks of friendships and relationships that even women, right, even isolating to the nuclear family, that we're not even connected to other generations that are also helping with the child rearing and household life. And so I just think also now even turning to some degree of like particular men's issues, right? Like maybe a question I would want to ask before we make sure we don't forget is, so men are not doing well in our current environment for all sorts of reasons. What are some bad steps to address that Christians have taken that you would want to protect against, maybe false readings of your book? What are some missteps of addressing men's issues? And then maybe I definitely want to ask, why do you think, what are the unique resources within the church to be able to address some of the issues that they're facing today?
Well, historically, I do deal with what was called muscular Christianity, which was a movement late 19th, early 20th century to try to recover a more masculine view of Christianity. And I think that was good to a large extent. It was good because I think one of you mentioned earlier, you know, the church had become feminized. Well, the church was feminized almost from day one. You know, let's face it, in the early church, some of the church fathers mentioned that the churches had far more women than men. It was hard to find young men, you know, for them to marry. So women have always been attracted to Christianity because Christianity gave women a much higher stature, standing than the surrounding culture, especially back in the early church. You know, the Roman culture had a very low view of women. Infanticide and abortion were committed primarily against girls. It was very rare for a Roman family to have more than one daughter. You know, they'd have a token daughter and that was it. And of course, as you probably know, the sexual ethic for men, well, you hardly can call it an ethic. Men could have sex with just about anyone they wanted to, and that was perfectly normal and accepted. They had mistresses, they went to brothels, prostitution. And of course, most of all, they're slaves. Most adultery happened with their own slaves. Adults and children, men and women. So there's a lot of homosexuality as well. In fact, I quote, well, not in this book, I'm sorry, in Love Thy Body, I quote a Roman writer who was chastising Roman wives for protesting when their husbands had sex with slave boys, saying, after all, you know, boys are more pleasurable than women are. So that was the ethos in the Roman era. And so naturally, you can see why women were attracted to the Christian church. And so I think, from what I can tell from history, there have been more women than men all from the beginning. There were more women than men in the first and second Great Awakenings. And so it's not so surprising that over time, the churches did feminize to some degree because, you know, pastors were ministering to congregations that were mostly women. Cotton Mather says that the churches in his area were like three quarters women. So it is not so surprising that pastors would begin to adapt their language and their approach to women. And even in our own day, the average congregation is 60% men, 60% women, 40% men. And more women than men go to Sunday school, go to small groups, more women than men go to Christian bookstores and so on. So I do think the muscular Christianity movement was a good thing. It was a helpful corrective. Unfortunately, over time, it tended to mirror the secular world, however, and beginning to denigrate women. You know, in taking women off the Victorian pedestal, then they then put them down a step or two below men. And I have several quotes from men, fundamentalist men. Fundamentalism would be like the 1920s.
Yeah, your Billy Sunday quotes are pretty spicy.
Aren't they fun? You can see why he was so popular. Mm-hmm. Even Mencken liked him. Did you remember that quote?
Yes. Yeah.
I thought that was funny. And Mencken said, I'm surprised at how many men come down to the front, you know, because nobody else was reaching men the way Billy Sunday was. But then there were some who began to denigrate women and to actually say that women were inferior to men spiritually and psychologically, and they began to curtail women's public ministry. So in the Second Great Awakening, most churches did not ordain women, but women had a wide range of public ministry still in terms of speaking before mixed audiences, which meant men and women, you know, and leading Bible studies. They called them exhorters. They could preach. They could be non ordained preachers, and they called them exhorters. And even in rural areas where men didn't want to go, women would be the sole pastor sometimes, especially in rural areas. So that began to be shut down. The fundamentalists tended to shut that down and say, you know, no, that's not appropriate for women. And, you know, women should be strictly home. You know, they should be strictly focusing on their families, to coin a phrase. and, you know, strictly involved in domestic arenas. So that's where I think I would say that was one faulty response, you know, to denigrate women, to see them as inferior. And I think that kind of kicked off the Christian feminist movement that followed, you know, that was kind of a reaction against it. So that would be one arena where, you know, the church did some good things, but then the church did some bad things as well. I'll give you just one quote. There was one of the fundamentalist leaders I quoted in the book advised seminary students to suppress your wife's ambition and quiet her tongue. That gives you kind of the tone of some of the fundamentalist literature.
One of the things I was just going to add a very brief comment just on that. It's not a question. So maybe Peter, if you have further questions, but one of the things I also just appreciated, though, that even in your book, especially just related to the men's issues of lack of connection to the fathers, and you shared very rawly in the introduction of your own story with your father, which we don't have to go into. And I actually, you know, I'm currently writing a piece sharing some of my own experience. Mm-hmm. So I've always had a strange relationship with the masculinity discourse. My relationship with my father was very similar, though he wasn't a Christian. And then I became a Christian later through a very gentle, kind man ministering to me. And so I've always had it, but I'm in kind of conservative circles. And so like I have this strange space of like, how do I think about masculinity? But one of the things that you mentioned in your book, and I just comment here, we'll see where else we want to go, but is it really, you just mentioned this, it can almost seem pithy to tell people, like there's a whole conversation right now going on about nature and grace, like nature doesn't just, grace doesn't destroy nature, but it perfects it and restores and perfects it or whatever. But there's also like, okay, but what about when nature's not working? I mean, so when someone like me doesn't have a father that they connect with, One of the great gifts of the church for me was to get a father, and it didn't build upon my experience of a father, but it in many ways did replace it. And so I think about the real gift of the church is, you talk about how it softens men up in their marriages and right, and it reconnects them to the home. But also, I think young men who lack fathers, I really would hope that they would find that experience both in their theological ultimate supernatural father, but also mentors in the church. I was just going to throw that in there.
No, that's very good. And it's interesting to me that some reviewers have really picked up on that. There was an article in Christianity Today, just days ago, which said, you know, Nancy Piercy says we should put a higher priority in the church on ministry to fatherless boys.
Yep.
And she's absolutely right. And I thought, great, he picked up on that. And I'm going to be speaking at the Heritage Foundation. And I'm going to end with that point. I'm going to say 40% of American children are growing up apart from their natural father. It is the highest rate of single parenthood in the world. And so we really should think about, you know, I was encouraged in my research to see people saying that father substitutes can, in fact, have an enormous difference. You know, grandparents and extended family, but teachers, coaches, big brother programs, church youth group leaders, they actually can have a really important impact. And you know what? Not even just men. I mean, I got my healing mostly through, you know, psychiatric social worker who worked at LaBrie, you know, when I was at LaBrie. It was a woman who showed me a quality of love that I had never experienced before. Mm-hmm. And when I left LaBrie, my image of God was kind of, you know, an image of that therapist in my mind, because, you know, that's the only way I could experience the love that was something I had never gotten from my family. So I would say it's better to be a man. It's good to be a father substitute, but anyone can step in and have an impact. And I think that's a wonderful way to, I'm going to end my talk at the Heritage Foundation with that, because I'm going to say, see, this is something anyone can do. We can all contribute to the father, to the problem of the boy crisis. Mm-hmm. Nobody has to sit on the sidelines, right? We can all have some role to play in helping fatherless boys.
Nancy, before you leave, though, one more thing is, where can our listeners find your book?
Yes, so The Toxic War on Masculinity is available at Amazon, like everything is. Although if you prefer, you can buy it from christianbook.com. And come to my website. My publisher very generously redesigned my website, so it's fun and colorful. So you can come and browse my other books. It's nancypiercy.com. Piercy is P-E-A-R-C-E-Y. So nancypiercy.com. Come and take a look at my other books, and you can leave a comment. I don't get to answer all of them, but I read them all. So come on by and say hello.
Nancy Piercy, has been delightful, and we could keep on talking for a long time. But we appreciate the time you've taken, and thank you for joining us. And to all of you listening, we look forward to the next time. James Wood and I as hosts, and look forward to the next Civitas podcast. God bless you all.